Our next session will be on the legacies of the war. We have three speakers. Again, their bios are, I think in this case, accurate. At least I haven't had any complaints from any of them. They are in the order of their appearance. Nguyen Ngoc Bích, Professor of Education at Georgetown. Charlie Hubbs, who was the head of the ranch hand operation in Vietnam from 66-67. And William Jane, Director of the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program. And gentlemen, we are running again behind, so if you'll try to keep your remarks, if you can pare them down, would be helpful.
So how long do you think I have?
Well, we were given this panel scheduled for an hour. If you were each to speak, we are already over half an hour late. Try about 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, I came here really full of ideas, and I could go on and on, but since I have 15 minutes, I'll try to keep that time. But there's still a small inaccuracy in the bio that I'd like to make, it, because if nothing else, to put on the record for accuracy's sake. And that is, I do not have the title of doctor. I am sometimes referred to as such simply because, I guess, of some of my writings. But I am at Georgetown, and the reason why I'd like to take this opportunity to speak to you about these segments called the Legacies of the War is precisely because I think you've heard it before. I'd like to repeat just this one point, and that is the Vietnamese viewpoint is more or less assimilated to the North Vietnamese viewpoint, and all Vietnamese of other colorations are for that simple process either forgotten or represented as some sort of puppet of the Americans. And since two of my other speakers in this panel are going to speak about the American part of it, so I'm going to keep myself to only the part that relates to Vietnam. Now, as you know, the Vietnamese, although we are from the East, we are not really well known for being philosophers. We haven't produced Socrates or Confucius for that matter. But we are what you call practical philosophers. And in relation to the media, we have an expression that's very short. It's only six words. I think all of you can learn it. It says, Làm báo, nói láo ăn tiền. Journalist makes a living by lying. Well, another practical philosophy that we have is this, again, is even shorter concept. It's only two words. It's called nói hậu. You know, when you give everybody the chance to speak, and then comes your turn, like me now, at the end of the conference, well, I can shoot down everybody, you know, and I'm in no danger of of being caught on this. Now, unfortunately, that is exactly what happened in the PBS series. We have quotations from American leaders and military and government presidents and things like that. Things that were said 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 15 years ago, and all these kind of things. And then you wait until now. Then you give a chance to the North Vietnamese to speak up. Of course, it couldn't be wrong, because they have this whole perspective to correct. How can they be expected to be wrong? This, the Vietnamese call nói hậu. You speak with hindsight, and you're always wiser when you speak with hindsight. Well, I'm not really... I don't want really to address the Stanley Connell's book, as sometimes has been said by Colonel Sommer, among others, that there's a difference between the book and the series. Well, yes, there is some, although I really disagree with the book. The book is a journalistic, it's a pretty good journalistic job. But as journalism goes, it's not really a history. It's anything but a history. It's an anecdotal type of report of something that includes a lot of misinformation in there that has been brought out. But since I said that I'm not going to touch it only when it relates to the book. But my problem is that sometimes I don't really know which way to fight, because there's all these things coming to me. There's the books, there's a teacher's guide, there's a PBS series, there's all these people out there who also joined the fray. Then I just don't know which way I turn. I even sometimes have to disagree with some of my friends, Vietnamese among others, or even among American friends, experts on Vietnam, who see who knows about the communists, and at the same time, who are unable to differentiate, among other things, the concept of the front. You know, people spend tons of papers to try to differentiate, let's say, between the NLF and the North Vietnamese. People try to say that the Viet Minh included nationalists. Yes, but the important point is not there. The important point is that it's a communist-run front. And if you don't know the concept of using a front to push your power, then you don't know the very first thing about communism. So then let's forget about saying that the NLF has people who are not really communists, or the Viet Minh having nationalists in there. The very plain fact is that whatever they are, they push a communist plan, a communist game plan, and that is what is important about. And that's exactly, we are going to see that repeated all over again in Central America. But the worst thing I've come to find about this particular segment that I'm supposed to address, the legacies of Vietnam, is that the very first legacy is a confusion of tongues. We are facing a Tower of Babel right here. And just to read to you something, in the debate between President Ford and President Carter, President Ford said about the amnesty, "I gave in September of 1974 an opportunity for all draft evaders, all deserters, to come in voluntarily, clear the records by earning an opportunity to restore their good citizenship. I don't think we should go any further." That's apparently President Ford's definition of amnesty. President Carter said, Jimmy Carter was then only the governor. He said, "Now I don't advocate amnesty. Listen, I advocate pardon." And this is the difference he gives. "There's a difference in my opinion." And I quote, "I am in accordance with the ruling of the Supreme Court and in accordance with the definition in the dictionary. Amnesty means that what you did was right. Pardon means that what you did, whether right or wrong, you're forgiven for it." Since I'm not a native speaker of English, when I ran across this, I rushed to the Third Webster International and tried to find out the difference between amnesty and pardon. And among other things, besides the garbled English that President Carter was using, there's no such thing. That amnesty means that which you did was right. There's no such thing. The only difference between amnesty and pardon is that an amnesty usually applies to a class of people. It's no difference whether it's right or wrong. Both of them implies pardon. One is larger and one is shorter. But the worst part about it is the very word legacy. Try to listen to what some of the definition of the legacy that we find in this section. And again, you know, the media, obviously, in trying to keep up to date, always try to relate Vietnam to Central America. So the narrator at one point said, "An American advisor in Honduras had his own Vietnam legacy to pass on to Salvadoran trainees." Again, you try to understand that. But I rushed to the West International and Random House and whatever, and I tried to look up legacy. And legacy, if anything, means a passing on of a patrimony. There's at least an idea of a generation between that involves legacy. I cannot pass my own legacy to myself. It's plain, stupid, dumb English. I may pass an experience of Vietnam to somebody. I didn't pass legacies to myself. Another, but that's not all. You know, the whole section started with, and please try to follow and give me your opinion about whether these would, you know, qualify as legacy. George Ball started by saying, "I think Vietnam was probably the greatest single error that America has made in its national history. Is that a legacy? Do we have a legacy of error?" Dean Rusk, I think Vietnam has at least for a period diverted our attention from this central issue of how the world is to organize itself to prevent World War III. Is that a legacy? Again, I think these are reflections. They're not really legacies. Then Bill Earhart, which was a veteran, said, "But for me, the greatest legacy," now the word he used is legacy, "of the war in Vietnam is that I will never believe my government again." Is that also a legacy? I think that's a lesson. Now there's a difference between a lesson and a legacy. Well, I think the whole thing is when it's, you know, spoken like that, then, you know, you just don't even know where to start because you're not really speaking people the same language. The very word Vietnam, the very word Tet, everything is so colored. Tet to the Vietnamese certainly do not mean just one Tet, 1980-68. Tet to the Vietnamese is a fantastically beautiful cultural concept. And yet, to the American, Tet means 1968. Vietnam to the Vietnamese means a lot more than the metaphor of Vietnam that people use when they say talk about no more Vietnams in speaking about El Salvador or Nicaragua. And so I would submit to you that in Vietnam, what we had was a legacy now, reflecting upon it almost 10 years later, a legacy of dependency, a legacy of conquest, a legacy of continuing war, a legacy of militarism, a legacy of disillusion, a legacy of divisions among the Vietnamese, a legacy of misery, a legacy of destitution, and a legacy of bitterness, to say the least. And for every single statement that I make here, I can easily demonstrate that dependency. The latest secret IMF report, International Monetary Fund report from North Vietnam, says that the foreign reserve exchange of North Vietnam now is it's at its lowest, $16 million for the whole country. $16 million. When you add that to the amount of gold that they manage to still keep in the country, something like about 700,000 ounces of gold, that would amount to 2 weeks of imports into the country. And even of the amount of gold that they had, more than half of it is already used as caution against a loan of $102 million. The dollar, which officially cost 3.5 dong in 1975 when the communists came into South, now costs 160 dong. Now this is the type of legacies that now we are seeing. The conquest of Cambodia, I don't need to elaborate. Yes, I don't need to elaborate. The continuing war, you know, most people, most Americans at least, in thinking that by pulling out of Vietnam, we'll solve the question. It's clear that this question is not solved. The war is much wider now. At least they have a two-fronted war, if not three. Because besides Cambodia and the Chinese border, they have a people very ready for rebellion right inside their home territory. Militarism. If the Vietnamese, who always prided themselves on being the more peaceful type of people in the world, now are considered like the Asian Prussians, all thanks to communism. Disillusion, division. Disillusion doesn't happen just in the case of the South Vietnamese, as the PBS series would tell you. It happens right in the ranks of the Vietnamese cadres and military people who came down south and all of a sudden found out that they've been cheated. That Saigon is about 100 times richer than North Vietnam. They say, you know, the joke in Vietnam now, it used to say that between Hanoi and Moscow, There's nothing to choose. Moscow is so much better than Hanoi. Between Hanoi, between Moscow and East Berlin is heaven. But if you compare East Berlin to Saigon, you are speechless. There's nothing to compare. So it's just that type of dissolution which is happening right now everywhere. The North Vietnamese newspaper are talking about it every day. Every day you just read the Tạp chí Cộng sản, the communist the journal that they have for the party. That's the one topic that keeps recurring. Article after article, pages after page. Division. They came in and they divided the Vietnamese into puppets, which happens to be all of South Vietnam, and the so-called revolutionaries, which are now so jealous of the puppets, because the puppets apparently had it so much better. Misery, destitution, bitterness. A few months back, there's an article by an American reporter from the New York Times. We came back, written in the New York Times magazines, and talk about a bitter peace. Yes, everything in Vietnam is so bitter. It's so bitter that the least thing that it can do, as if when they did the PBS series 6 years after the end of the war in Vietnam, is to look at the facts. And the fact says, among other things, that in 4,000 years of history, the Vietnamese have never left their land. In 30 years of the most devastating war that you had, no Vietnamese tried to run away from Vietnam. Why is it that in 6 years of peace or 8 years of peace or something, we have over 1 million people desperately trying against, you know, all the risk of sea piracy in Thailand, of an incredible about obstruction and obstacle outside. Right here in Washington, I know of a Vietnamese who ran his wheelchair 800 kilometers from Saigon across Cambodia into Thailand. How do people do things like that? I think this is something that needs to be looking into. Well, I think since my time is coming up, I mean, it is getting over. So, yeah, that's right. So, I only want to do two things. One is, I don't know whether you are familiar with this, but Penguin Books, in pushing for the paperback editions of Stanley Karnov's book, has changed slightly, and this is the note of optimism that I like to end on. You know, his book, it says it's the first complete account of Vietnam. It's called a history. He doesn't pull it. Now, according to this thing, is Vietnam a history is the first complete account of the American involvement in Vietnam. There's a difference, you know. There's a huge difference right there. But a second thing, too, that Mr. Kano admits, because when the question was that, what is it that in your book that hasn't been written about before? Well, he mentions various things. But one of the things he says, for the first time, I tell the story of the war from the communist side. So do not put it in my mouth that I said anything about Mr. Stanley Karnov being a fellow traveler. Thank you.
Okay, come on, Charlie Helms.
You just got lucky. That 30 minutes got cut to 15, and on my own, I'll just take out that 10 right in the middle, and we'll just have the opening and the closing. Now, I appreciate this opportunity to speak out as a Vietnam veteran and a private citizen on the harm the media can do. I am particularly concerned about the subject of disinformation. Now, I'm not speaking of misinformation. I could forgive a cub reporter making an inaccurate statement once. But in the case of herbicides, the PBS show is an excellent example of what can happen to people that are conditioned to a bunch of facts that they hear, but they aren't facts. Now, this factual information has always been available to the press, and they've intentionally ignored it. And it took what appears to me to be a planned campaign by the media to inflate this herbicide horror story that they're telling to the level they've reached. But first of all, let me tell you how Agent Orange, I'm even saying it now, they got me brainwashed. Let me tell you how AIM found me. I had a little heartburn over an article that the Washington Post had written. A nice young lady, I suppose she's nice, probably even has a mother. But anyway, she... I don't know. She alluded to the ranch hands. We're kind of proud of our name. We came home with honor. We never had any problem with that. She got pretty cute. She called us the ranch handlers. And she said that when we flew over, 300-foot trees toppled literally right behind us. If that had happened, I would have spent about 3 weeks in Vietnam, and I'd have been home, and that would have been the end of the war. But we didn't have anything quite that potent, I'm afraid, with us. I tried dealing with the Post by calling the lady. She wouldn't return my calls. I tried calling the editor, and of course, whoever that may be, he or she is also too busy to answer an irate citizen's request for a little accuracy in their bloody paper. And the next thing I know, somebody put me on to the Omnibudsman. Well, that took a few phone calls, but he actually answered me. And shortly after he answered me, he called me back and made the greatest statement of the world. I was right. But his recommendation to me was, write a letter to the editor. I won't tell you what I said, because I'm a little ashamed of my language at the time, but I inferred some things about his ancestry and a few other things, and then recommended that since they wrote it, why don't they do something about it? And all I got from that was sorry and case closed. I went to a friend who was in the Rotarians, and he offered me the option to speak one night, or the opportunity, I should say, and I spoke. This was on a Monday. By Friday, I had spoken to not only Rotarians, but Kiwanis groups, and somewhere along the line, Reed asked me to speak at an AIM group. I noticed in the room Pentagon people, Washington Post people, and within 2 days, a writer by the name of Pete Early called me and told me that the Washington Post had decided perhaps they'd been a little harsh about Agent Orange, and they wrote what I considered to be, what I considered to be an objective article, and I stopped my speaking tour. So it can be done. Only it can't be done by one person. You really need an organization, and I'm just pleased as punch that Reed took me off the street from the... By the way, the food's a lot better at AIM things. Boy, nothing wrong with Rotarians and Kiwanis. They just don't eat very well. Let's just jump past all my griping at the press and get down to the problem that the PBS folks had. They've just been inundated with what I consider terribly erroneous information about the effects of Agent Orange. The fact that we dumped it all over the troops, we owe that to Secretary Swiker. And I will say that he was given that by a staff member. The staff member was totally wrong. The staff member then regrouped and found out that it wasn't 89 times that we dumped our load on our troops. And when I say dumped our load, I mean the whole 1,000 gallons right now in 30 seconds to a minute. They found out it was actually we had dumped 2 times. We dumped off the end of the runway, right in the armament drop zone. And that's where the fighters and bombers drop their bombs if they have a problem on takeoff. And if you think anybody's living out there or anybody's walking around out there, wrong. Yeah. They say we were spraying all over the troops. Well, I guess they didn't read our frag orders too well, because for the entire time I was there, and I'm going to speak from 66 to 67 very explicitly, because I was the detachment commander at Da Nang. I didn't run the entire ranch. I headed the detachment at Da Nang, which was half the squadron. I never flew a flight that had less than three camouflaged airplanes. I want to make that point clear early. That didn't have at least 3 fighters, and that I did not have the option of blowing hell out of everything in front of me or around me on the ground. Now, if you think Americans were down there or friendly forces, you got it all wrong. All I sprayed was lines of communications and military targets, and I'll guarantee you we expended one hell of a lot of fighters' ammunition during those missions, and there weren't any Americans down there. So much for this spraying them and dousing them and everything. Along that line, 3 gallons of herbicide was what we put on per acre. That was what we put out of our aircraft. It was atomized as it came out of the aircraft. I defy anybody to take 3 gallons of atomized anything from 100 feet in the air and make a puddle. So much for puddles in the jungle. I've had my aircraft shot up. I had 411 missions. I had to come home early. They didn't like me flying anymore. I was enjoying it a lot. But I was trying to get promoted. But anyway, we figured that only 6% of that, by the way, ever reached the ground in a triple canopy jungle. 6% of the 3 gallons actually reached the ground. And sunlight most of it was degradable. Not all of it. A lot of it was degradable. So it didn't last too long either on the leaves of the trees. There's a little line in the PBS thing about civilians. Now, I'm not going to deny there were any civilians under us because I don't know. I couldn't see through the jungle. I know there's a lot of people down there shooting at me. Maybe there were civilians. I have seen in some open stretches some people that didn't have black pajamas on shooting at me. That doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't VC. I don't know how all the VC dressed. But I do know one thing, that any time that we sprayed anywhere in South Vietnam, it was the province chief that picked the target and asked us to hit it. Now, they're his people. I don't know what he was doing with that. I can't answer for the province chiefs or the military commander, which was also a Vietnamese. So we were working on their orders. So, again, if somebody comes back in later years and said we're out there promiscuously spraying the civilian population, they better go back and talk to their own leadership on that. We didn't fly day-to-day over the same area. That would have been suicide. Remember, we're flying at 100 feet, 150 miles an hour. You never went back on the same target twice. Hell, we got daylight's blown out of us the first time. We didn't go back, just wake them up, get them woke up so they'd get more clips and go back the next day and let them shoot at us. Improve their lead on us? I don't think so. I served as a technical advisor to the VA Committee on Effects of Herbicide on Military Personnel in Vietnam. I have heard and read the most knowledgeable results of surveys to date, and I have seen no link that concerns me. And I am concerned. As I stand here, I've been advised I am not less than, but possibly 1,000 times have been, 200, 400, or 1,000 times more exposed than any GI on the ground. Pick any number you want. I've heard them all. The Air Force loves me. They just think I'm the greatest walking thing they've got. But I am concerned. I'm concerned about 200, 400, or 1,000 more times than the average GI about the effects of herbicide. I'd like to see the media become as concerned about treating this subject objectively as I am about its outcome. And with that, I will leave you.
As the last speaker in quite a long presentation today, I guess I want to, first of all, thank you in advance for your patience and consideration.
You're
and
not the last. We have one more to go.
Okay. I'll try and make it as quickly as possible. PBS's television history of Vietnam presents the Vietnam veterans of today as haunted, the word they use. A visible and dramatic reminder of the tragedy and waste of our involvement in the war. The veterans presented on camera in episode 13 are bitter, angry, confused. Only one, Tommy Lyons, a Marine from South Boston, gives a hint that this picture of Vietnam veterans is distorted, inaccurate. His simple statement, "I was honored to go," provides the only indication that the overwhelming majority of veterans are well-adjusted, productive members of society. Now, I don't know anything about what I don't want to say anything about what I think the intentions and so forth of the people who put together the PBS series are, but I think what's at stake here in the treatment of veterans, the media stereotype of veterans, is the notion of service in a free society, that these all of us who served did so ultimately, I think, in accordance with one basic motivation. We obeyed the law. We didn't always know exactly what it is that we were fighting for at the age of 18 or 19. We knew it was right, though, to obey the law. And as free citizens, we had an obligation to serve when called upon. This is, I think, what's at stake in the media portrayal of Vietnam veterans as haunted and all the rest of it. I want to try to address a few of the specific kinds of myths that surround Vietnam veterans, the myths that underlie the presentation of veterans in the PBS series. I'm going to bear with me as I skip through this and try to shorten it up a little bit. Now, what are veterans like today? There are 7 million, there are about a little over 9 million Americans who served in the armed forces during the Vietnam era, which is officially defined as August 1964 to May 1975. About 3.4 million of those 9 million served in the theater, including offshore waters, and about 2.6 or 2.7 million actually served in Vietnam on the ground. What are they like today? Most decidedly, they do not fit the stereotype of the bitter, haunted, confused veteran portrayed by PBS. And it should be noted that while statistical evidence exists which refutes the stereotype, complete statistics on the incidence of problems such as divorce, alcoholism, suicide, and the rest do not exist. The Veterans Administration is right now in the process of contracting for a so-called needs assessment of Vietnam veterans that, it is hoped, will provide more definitive statistics by 1988. I think you heard a little bit earlier today about the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program, the program that I work for. It's a network of voluntary organizations around the country where successful Vietnam veterans serve as volunteers to help our fellow veterans in a number of ways, primarily employment. One of our volunteers, Rich Cobb, a petroleum engineer in Houston, Texas today, who served as an enlisted man, an infantryman in Vietnam, put together a list of statistics and presented them in the format of a fiction and the facts that rebut those fictions, those myths. I'll read real quickly from a few of these. Myth, a large percentage of Viet vets have rejected patriotism. In fact, 91% of actual Vietnam War veterans and 90% of those who saw heavy combat are proud to have served their country. B, 66% of veterans say that they would serve again if called upon. Fiction, guilt overwhelms most Vietnam veterans. Fact, A, 66% of Vietnam veterans reject the notion of guilt totally. B, only 14% of Vietnam veterans feel unequivocally that, quote, it is shameful what my country did to the Vietnamese people. Fiction, political radicalism is more the rule than the exception among Vietnam veterans. Fact, A, only 15% of Vietnam veterans identified themselves as radicals in 1973. A time when the so-called Veterans Anti-War Movement was at its zenith. B, membership in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW admitted everyone from college students to professors, by the way, probably peaked at 7,000, one-fourth of 1% of all Vietnam veterans. Fiction, marital failure is rampant among Vietnam-era veterans. Fact A, in the only comprehensive survey conducted, released in 1979, 7.3% of Vietnam era veterans.